Okay, I'd like to get started, please. I'm really delighted to see all of you here. This is just a wonderful turnout for our program today. My name's Jeremy Rosenblum. I'm a member of the board of the Middle East Forum and also a partner here at Ballard Spire, Andrews and Ingersoll. It's our pleasure to welcome you all here to this event. I think it should be a fantastic presentation. Before introducing our speaker, David Gardenstein-Ross, I'd like to take a moment and just talk about the good works of the Middle East Forum and encourage you to join it if you're not currently a member. Under Daniel Pipe's direction, the Forum works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. It's consistently played and displayed an unparalleled grasp of key issues, whether in exposing the threat of radical Islam, working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel, urging the Bush administration to better manage its pro-democracy efforts, thinking through strategies to contain the Iranian threat, or through its Campus Watch project, which is something of particular interest to me with two kids in college, which critiques the extremist orthodoxy that dominates Middle Eastern studies at North American universities. Through research, publishing, media work, and public education, including today's program, the Forum energizes the public debate by addressing a range of issues and by offering fresh and sound perspectives on policy. If you've not done so already, I'd like to encourage you to add your name to the Forum's email list, which should be in this room somewhere, and that way receive Middle East Forum materials as they appear. Alternatively, you can go directly to the Forum's website, which is www.meforum.org. to sign up and to read about our work. I hope you find the Forum's efforts worthy of your support. At this point, before we begin, I'd like to ask everybody to switch off your mobile phones and pagers. We'll hold questions until the presentation will be a short discussion followed by questions and answers. So if you can hold your questions and answers, that would be good. The Q&A will be moderated by Marilyn Stern, who is the co-vice chair of the Philadelphia Board. This lecture is part of the Harry and Martha Stern Memorial Lecture Series, which is named in honor of Marilyn's father-in-law and mother-in-law. In any event, the Middle East Forum is very pleased to present David Gardenstein-Ross, who's an expert on counterterrorism and has had a very interesting path to his current work. Gardenstein-Ross will discuss his newly released memoir, My Year Inside Radical Islam. His story, I think, is unique and compelling. There are very few of us, nobody in this room I trust other than David, who have worked for an Al-Qaeda-linked organization, much less the FBI as well. Raised in a non-practicing Jewish family, Mr. Gardenstein-Ross converted to Islam in his 20s and worked for the Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, which was an ostensible charity that laundered money for Al-Qaeda. Just before, I think this must be David's words, just before going off the deep end of radical Islam, that's not my thought, he pulled back and subsequently served as an FBI informant in its investigation of Al-Haramain. Now a senior consultant for the Girard Group International, a counterterrorism and homeland security firm, Mr. Gardenstein-Ross advises federal and local enforcement agencies, analyzes threats, and conducts training seminars. He was senior analyst at the Investigative Project on Terrorism in Washington, D.C., a commercial litigator at the Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, and a law clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He holds degrees from Wake Forest University and NYU School of Law. His articles have appeared in periodicals such as the Wall Street Journal Europe, the Washington Times Commentary, and the Weekly Standard. He's a frequent guest on television and talk radio shows. So please welcome me and join me in welcoming Mr. Gardenstein-Ross.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining me this afternoon. As was said, I'm, I guess, one of the few people who in this room who worked for both an Al-Qaeda linked charity and also for the FBI. The group that I worked for, I worked for the U.S. headquarters of the Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, which at the time was one of the world's largest Wahhabi organizations, Wahhabism being Saudi Arabia's austere form of Islam and an ideology that serves as an inspiration for a number of different contemporary terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. When I worked for Al-Haramain, it had offices in more than 50 countries, an annual budget from $30 to $80 million a year, and was also a major financier for Al-Qaeda. What my book is about is life on the inside of a radical Islamic charity and the process of indoctrination, the process of radicalization that comes with that, the process of radicalization that I went through. And I think that it's this process of radicalization that I really wanted to shed light on in writing the book, because analysts now are very concerned about the threat of homegrown terrorism as represented by such men as John Walker Lind, who was found fighting on the side of the Taliban in Afghanistan after 9/11, or Adam Gadan, who's now an Al-Qaeda spokesman who can be seen on a number of different propaganda tapes for the terrorist organization. I think this is a process that we know far too little about, and it will be a critical one to understand over the coming years. With that idea in mind, I want to now turn to the story of how someone from a liberal Jewish background got mixed up with radical Islam, and then I'll open up the floor for questions. I grew up in a small town called Ashland in southern Oregon. Ashland is a hippie town, and my parents were New Age hippie Jews. My religious upbringing was unusual, as reflected by the artwork that we had up around the house. Various scenes from Jesus' life graced the living room. There was a small statue of Buddha in the backyard. Essentially, my parents were sort of Unitarian Jews who esteemed both Jesus and Buddha equally. By the spring of 1997, in part because of a couple of brushes with death due to illness, I was very interested in moving beyond what I saw as a fairly squishy religious upbringing and finding answers about God for myself. It was that semester that I became friends with Al-Hussein Madhani. Like me, Al-Hussein was a student at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and he was the first practicing Muslim that I knew. He was a tall Kenyan-born man of Indian-American parents, and it was he who first taught me about Islam. As he did, the faith became more and more enticing to me. Islam, Al-Hussein taught me, is a simple faith. I learned that Muslims believe in the same prophets as Christians and Jews, and the same God. Muslims believe that Muhammad was the final prophet. They believe that God revealed Islam's holy book, the Quran, to Muhammad. My studies about the faith convinced me that true Islam was moderate. There were undoubtedly some extremists, but Christianity also had its own dark periods, and one couldn't impute the actions of a few outliers to the entire body of believers. As I learned more about Islam, it felt not only comfortable, but also familiar, and eventually I converted in the fall of 1997. It was by chance that my first job after college was at a radical Wahhabi charity. I was back in Ashland in the summer of 1998, visiting my parents. There was a local Muslim community there that I had encountered once before. I decided to pay them another visit, going to the Friday afternoon Jummah prayers. The last time I attended, the prayers were held in the back room of the house of a local congregant, a man named Pete Seda, who is now under federal indictment. This time, though, when I called ahead to verify the time and place of prayers, I was told that services had moved to a new location on the south end of town. They were now located no longer in the back of some guy's house, but in a mansion-sized building. There were expansive fields surrounding it. Horses, a donkey, and even a dromedary camel roamed these fields. It was clear that the group had more money than ever before. After services were over, Pete Seda gave me a tour of the property. He explained how they were able to afford all of this, telling me that the local congregation had become affiliated with a Saudi Arabian charity called the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation. Pete had big plans and encouraged me to apply for a job there. And so, my first job between college and law school was with an Islamic charity that's now a designated terrorist organization. When I first accepted the job, I assumed that I wouldn't see eye to eye with my coworkers on some spiritual matters. I practiced a very moderate and progressive form of Islam. This was the pre-9/11 world, where Wahhabism wasn't on people's minds the way it is today. But I nonetheless knew that the practices within this organization wouldn't mesh with my view of the faith. Little did I realize, though, that instead of simply agreeing to disagree, my ideas would come to fall into line with those of Al Haramain. A few incidents helped to illuminate my spiritual development. I quickly realized that there were a number of restrictions in my coworkers' practice of Islam that I had never knew existed. Ramadan began at the same time I started my job, and one day I read a wire story about it in a local newspaper. The story mentioned that during the fast, Muslims refrain from food, drink, sexual intercourse, and listening to music during the day. I had never heard of this last restriction. When I got into work, I asked one of my coworkers, Dawood, about it. "Practicing Muslims shouldn't listen to music at all," he said. "What?" Immediately, I regretted that I had asked this question. "Yes," Dawood said. "The Prophet, peace be upon him, spoke about this issue directly. It has nothing to do with Ramadan. We shouldn't be listening to music, period." I must have looked skeptical, because Dawood came into the office half an hour later, carrying a slim hardcover book, Muhammad bin Jamil Zeno's Islamic Guidelines for Individual and Social Reform. This was the first time I saw the book, but it wouldn't be the last. Dawood had put a yellow tab on one of the pages. He handed the volume to me. "If you have doubts about the harms of music, brother," he said, "you should read this. It explains the Islamic position." My head swam as I read through the barrage of evidence that purportedly showed the harms of music. As I tried to parse it, Dawood re-entered the office. "Well, what do you think?" he asked. I shrugged. "I didn't know that before," I said. I didn't say whether I would comply with this ruling. At the time, it seemed unfathomable that I would. That Ramadan, a sheikh came to visit us. Born in Egypt, Muhammad Adli was a short man with a large gray beard that seemed to run the length of his body. The others appeared to revere him. Sheikh Adli was visiting to teach classes on Islam and make a video detailing how to make salat, Islamic prayers, properly. One day, after we'd shot footage for the video, Pete told me that I should give the sheikh a ride to the home of one of our producers. I immediately walked to my car to make sure there weren't random papers strewn about on the passenger seat. As I walked toward the renter cell, a dark-haired woman who looked to be in her late 30s greeted me. She wasn't wearing the hijab, the headscarf worn by Muslim women. I was surprised to see her, and it took me a second to realize the reason for my surprise. It had been weeks since I'd actually had contact with the woman, and to my dismay, her lack of hijab struck me as wrong. The woman introduced herself as an elementary school teacher. She wanted to bring her class to the prayer building, she said, to teach them about the Islamic faith. She asked who she should talk to about this. I told her that Pete was the person to ask, and then I glimpsed Sheikh Adli out of the corner of my eye. He stood a short distance away, far enough that he wouldn't have to introduce himself, but close enough that he could listen in on the conversation. When my brief conversation with the teacher ended, she stuck out her hand and said, "I appreciate the help. It was nice talking to you." I hesitated and let her stand there with her hand sticking out. Then I said, somewhat embarrassed, "No thanks." I felt uncomfortable shaking her hand with the sheikh watching. She gave me a perturbed look. The awkwardness was all my fault. My coworker Dennis Guerin had prepared a semi-humorous spiel to explain to women why he wouldn't shake their hands. It included the line, "You probably shouldn't shake my hand unless you want to marry me." I had never prepared such a speech, but clearly no thanks did not do the trick. The teacher turned and walked to her car without saying another word. When Sheikh Adli got into my cell, he explained in a soft, meandering voice that a lot of non-Muslims don't understand and don't like the rules that we Muslims follow. "That woman," he said, She didn't understand when you didn't want to shake her hand. I nodded. Sheikh Adli and I hadn't talked much during his time in Ashland, but it was now just the two of us in my car. Sheikh Adli asked me a few basic questions. He wanted to know how I came to Islam, what my future plans were. When I told him that I would be going to law school in the fall, he shook his head as though astonished. You should not go to law school, he said. If you go to law school, you will have to say that the Constitution is good. But after 3 months at Al Haramain, I began to believe in new rules and moral injunctions that I never could have accepted before. I became amenable to the idea that Sharia, or Islamic law, may be the best way to govern a society. In particular, the very strict version of Sharia that was propounded within this organization. Weren't God's decrees superior to the shifting sands of modern morality? And with that, many of my old liberal assumptions came crashing down. Why shouldn't the state ban homosexuality? Or why shouldn't it enforce the modesty of women? I began to take these questions seriously. Around the same time, my college friend Al-Hussein started to embrace a more radical interpretation of Islam as well. Before that, he had served as a bulwark against extremism. Al-Hussein and I would have long conversations in which we would criticize the extremists while trying to balance our liberal principles with our desire to be true to the faith. But as the summer of 1999 began, it became obvious that I was losing him to a conservative interpretation. Without Al-Hussein's support, it was difficult to resist the draw I felt to more conservative religious ideas. One of the biggest steps, the bridge where I began to accept a purely legalistic view of the faith, came when I decided to stop listening to music. It was not an easy step. I had loved music ever since I was a kid and had an enormous CD collection. But ever since Dawood first lectured me about the impropriety of music, I struggled with whether I should remove it from my life. It seemed unfathomable that I could quit something that had meant so much to me, but I felt that I needed to make a decision. I drove by Tercel past the golf course, toward the lake. Driving often helped me to clear out my head and think. As I drove, I listened to a mixtape that I had made in college. Each song seemed to hold some long-forgotten memory. But this would have to end, I decided. There were my coworkers, but there was also my relationship with Allah. Was music prohibited by Islamic law? I couldn't deny the power of some of the evidence that it was. If I really believed in Allah, I had to be honest. Even if some music were lawful, the music I was listening to was not. Stringed instruments were well known to be haram, or forbidden. And the themes of my music? Allah, I knew, wouldn't approve. There were songs about sex, songs about drugs. Most of the music I listened to seemed religiously inappropriate in some way. I drove back towards the house, knowing that this would be the last time that I enjoyed the music that I used to love so much. As I got close to home, I decided to take one last lap around the block, a chance to listen to one more song. As Jimi Hendrix's Easy Rider reached its crescendo, I pulled into the driveway. I ejected the cassette from the car's tape player. I then held the tape in my hand and sat looking at it. Already, I was regretting the loss of music. I brought the tape into my room, thinking about how music was a temptation. I needed finality, I believed. So I took the tape in both hands and squeezed until it snapped in two. In that instance, the broken tape seemed like a symbol. I was turning my back on a life of not being serious about my faith. Then I grabbed a Kleenex from the side of my bed and wrapped the tape inside of it. I didn't want my parents to see. I thought about how they had introduced me to music. I remembered that they had given me a tape of the Beatles' Abbey Road when I was just 6 years old. Old enough for the album to hold my interest, but too young to recognize its true brilliance. I wasn't hiding the tape because my parents would be upset that I'd given up on music. It was larger than that. My parents had no problem with my conversion to Islam because our ideas about faith had been so similar thereafter. But no longer. I was now careening down a new road and didn't know where it would lead me. But I knew that my ideas about religion were no longer like those of my parents. And I knew that these differences would hurt them deeply. So I end the reading from my book there, where I began to accept a very conservative, purely legalistic interpretation of the faith. I hadn't yet come to embrace truly radical ideas about jihad, about the punishment for apostasy, or other things, but those views would come in time. I did manage to reconstruct my faith later on, eventually leaving Islam altogether in 2000. As for Al-Haramain, its involvement in radical Islam has become more evident over the years. Its offices played a key role in the 1998 embassy bombings in East Africa. Many branches of the organization have been designated terrorist sponsors by the Treasury Department, including offices in Afghanistan, Albania, Bangladesh, Comoros, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Kenya, Pakistan, Somalia, Tanzania, the list goes on. The U.S. office where I worked was also designated, and two directors were indicted for their role in a somewhat complex money laundering scheme that federal investigators believe was used to finance the Mujahideen in Chechnya. It should be said that there are different paths out of radicalism. While I left Islam, my friend Al-Hussein Madhani, who I mentioned during this speech, also reconstructed his faith around the same time that I did. Although Al-Hussein remains a devout Muslim today, although one with a far different interpretation of the faith than he had when I feared that I was losing him to extremism. On balance, I don't regret my year inside radical Islam. I learned a lot about myself and a lot about an ideology that today is America's most deadly foe. But the most important thing that I came to understand is the strength of my vital relationships. The fact that those who are closest to me saw me descend into the views that I held, and the fact that they remain close to me today says, I think, something very good about the people that I hold dear. And with that, I'd like to open this up to any questions you might have.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Stern, and I'll be conducting the Q&A. I'd like to ask the first question, if I may. The American Muslim phenomenon. When reading articles about it, it states that there are disaffected youth amongst them, but it doesn't give conclusions how that will play out. What do you anticipate that role playing? And as well, with many liberal parents sending their kids to campus, how would you advise them to defend themselves?
As to the first of these, disaffection within the Muslim community runs quite deep, and it's not something that is beginning with this generation of Muslim youth. Rather, in discussing this phenomenon with friends and contacts of mine within the Muslim community, they say this goes back for several generations, probably to their parents' generation at the very least. And there's very much a predominating sense of otherness, of being separate from society, and not necessarily caused by Islamic ideology. Some of it is caused by the view of, well, you know, we're a minority here, people are out to get us. There's a lot of conspiratorial views, not necessarily grand conspiracy views, but views that, you know, that Muslim charities are being unfairly targeted, a lot of suspicion of law enforcement, a lot of suspicion of the war on terror writ large. And one way that this plays out, which I think is harmful, is a general lack of partnership between the Muslim community and law enforcement, which I think is a problem. If you look at some of the recent terror busts that we've had, like there's a Canadian terror cell that was broken up in June of 2006. There was a terror cell affiliated with Al-Qaeda in Lackawanna, New York. In both of those instances, the people who tipped off authorities were themselves Muslim. And I think that if this distrust continues to grow, you have the danger that that Muslims will be unwilling to cooperate, which puts us in much greater danger. I think another thing is that when you have a mentality, a conspiratorial mentality, and a mentality that we are separate from this society, that's the kind of thing that allows radicalism to flourish. You can see that much more dramatically in Europe than in the United States, where in countries like Britain, you have a great deal of radicalism. There have been a number of British Pakistani Muslims who've gone to Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in Pakistan in recent years and are expected to be serving as some as kind of sleeper agents in Britain itself. Likewise, the Netherlands, you had the murder of Theo van Gogh, a filmmaker who made a movie called Submission, critical of the treatment of women born into Muslim families. He was murdered on the street by an Islamic radical, shot 6 times, his throat slit, and the knife used to impale a threatening note to his chest. Like, this is a phenomenon that's very much occurring in Europe. And one thing that I think is critical is understanding both similarities and differences between the American Muslim community and the European one, so that you can try to prevent the same phenomenon that we see in Europe from happening here in the United States. As to, you know, liberal parents and how to guard your kids from extremist ideology, personally, I think one thing that helps people become more attracted to extremist religious ideology is when kids aren't raised with any sort of religious tradition. I mean, that was the mode that I fell into. Other prominent Western converts who've become radicalized, like John Walker Lind, Adam Gadon, had a very similar spiritual upbringing to mine, where they were kind of left to work things out for themselves. I mean, probably if I'd been raised, you know, an Orthodox or conservative Jew, even if I had become a Muslim, I would be more used to religious debates, more used to understanding, you know, different strains of religious thought, and more prone to understanding, you know, how religion is interpreted. I think when people don't have that grounding in religion, often it's those guys who speak with the loudest voice and who hold the podium who end up influencing them greatly. And, you know, I know a lot of, I've spoken to a lot of converts to Islam who've had similar experiences of getting sucked into the Wahhabi movement and adopting radical views themselves.
Let's open up the floor.
What is your opinion as to why there has not been another attack on the United States since 9/11?
The question is, why do I think there hasn't been another terrorist attack in the U.S. since 9/11? I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One reason is surely our aggressive policing efforts. After 9/11, the U.S. government adopted what John Ashcroft dubbed the Al Capone style of fighting terrorism. That is, you know, during the ascendancy of the mob, there was the view that, you know, when you knew that they were mobsters, when they walked like a mobster, talked like a mobster, and you were pretty sure what they were doing, even if you couldn't get them for being a mobster, you'd get them for what you could. Robert F. Kennedy, when he was Attorney General, said that he would arrest a mobster for spitting on the sidewalk if he had to do that. And, you know, after 9/11, you could see a lot of arrests that were clearly related to terrorism, but where the charges were not terrorism related, where the charges were, you know, immigration violations, certain money laundering charges that didn't necessarily have a terrorism nexus. In fact, the Al-Haramain charges that Group I was working for, the indictment doesn't have anything related to terrorism in it. It does mention that the money that was smuggled out of the country went to the Chechen Mujahideen, but they're not, and the two men who were indicted were neither indicted for material support of terrorism nor for violations of the Neutrality Act. Instead, it was solely financial violations. And part of that comes down to the difficulty of prosecuting some of these terrorist cases. So one thing is the aggressive policing. A second thing is honestly, Al-Qaeda set itself such a high bar on 9/11, and it wants to equal that with the next attack. You know, if you blow up the World Trade Center, blow up the Pentagon, and then your next attack is like destroying a Sbarro's pizzeria, it's going to look particularly unimpressive. So in Ron Susskind's book, The 1% Doctrine, a book that made great waves last summer, one thing he talks about was a chemical weapons plot that was aimed at the New York subway system. Ultimately, Zawahiri, Bin Laden's deputy, ended up nixing this plot. And the reason why is because even though it involved chemical weapons, he didn't think that it would have been destructive enough in terms of the loss of life to equal 9/11. So he didn't want to move forward with it.
On my left, middle of the room.
He went to a college called Wake Forest. He's been invited to study in a very nice college. Now,
speak up, please.
What attracted you to the Muslim world in this sort of not a, you know, I wouldn't say it's not the mainline, but it certainly is a off the road a little bit.
The question is, I went to Wake Forest, which is a nice southern college, and in an environment like that, what attracted me to Islam? I think there's a few things. I mean, for one, when I went to Wake Forest, the culture there was unfamiliar to me. It was my first time living in the South, you know, after growing up in this hippie town in southern Oregon. Kind of the conservative values that pervaded on campus at the time were a bit unfamiliar. There's also a significant socioeconomic status difference between me and most of my classmates. I grew up from kind of a thoroughly middle class in a thoroughly middle class background. If you looked at the parking lot at Wake Forest, you had these sports sedans there, the kind which I never could have afforded. So I felt a little bit disaffected there. And part of it was also just a relationship thing, which a lot of times is how people religious conversion occurs. You know, you meet someone who's charismatic, someone who seems to be, as my friend Aldo Saint was, charismatic, someone who seemed to be unusually attuned to political and social things, it's a personality that I found very compelling, and was interested in what drove him. And so one thing I became interested in was his faith. I think one thing for people especially who are somewhat disaffected by their surroundings or searching, sometimes the otherness of Islam can be a very attractive thing. And certainly if you look at the history of American converts, that seems to be a common predominating theme in addition to other things that attract people to Islam, such as community, form of worship, and the like.
In the middle, Dr. Stitt.
Yes. Do you have an opinion as to the American Muslim community, percentages of people who see themselves as loyal Americans first, and versus those who are loyal to Islam, the rules of Islam first? And secondly, within those who you've met, is there a stark difference between those types of people? And lastly, is there anything that the our society can do to help get them to feel more loyal to America than they?
The question, it's a three-part question, dealing with, in the American Muslim community, what percentages see themselves loyal to America first, versus what percentages see themselves as loyal to Islam first. In terms of percentages, I think it's hard to say. It's an empirical question, and one where I think that it's not necessarily indicative of radicalism if one sees their first allegiance to Islam. The question is whether they see, I think the greater question is whether they see this gulf between the two. For example, many people of faith, whether Jewish, Christian, Muslim, will see that they have a primary obligation to their faith first. And they'll be part of American society, but where American society conflicts with their faith, they'll go with the teachings of their faith. So, for example, you have a number of Christian lawyers, very devout Christian lawyers, who have the goal of overturning Roe v. Wade. I mean, that's something that is now enshrined as being constitutional law by the Supreme Court. But these lawyers will oppose that through litigating this and trying to challenge abortion laws. I don't think that's problematic. What is problematic is when you think that not only is your religion separate, but it's in opposition to the society that you're living in. And that's something that's taught by a lot of 20th century Islamic theologians like Hassan al-Banna, Sayyid Qutb, and the like. I don't know what percentage there is. I mean, I think it's clear that the majority of American Muslims are moderate, but you definitely have both factions of radicalism, and also one phenomenon you have is that increasingly progressive Muslims are finding places to network outside of the mosque, which causes what one American Muslim has referred to as mosques degenerating down to the most conservative common denominator, because progressives will end up going elsewhere in order to find community. And that's a problematic phenomenon, one which ultimately I think it takes progressive and liberal Muslims making more of an effort to engage in their community in order to solve that. Whether there's a stark difference between the two, yes and no. I mean, for some guys, it's clear where their allegiance lies. And some people will make no qualms about their radicalism. For other guys, it's very difficult to tell where their allegiances are. And I don't think there's I don't think there's at all a perfect litmus test. For me, part of what I do in interacting with the Muslim community is just try to get a feel for where someone stands. And a lot of times, that involves, you know, talking about difficult subjects and seeing where someone comes down. Now, as to what we can do to encourage that, I think this is an important question. Actually, there's a study that I'm going to be working on for an intelligence agency over the coming months, talking about the differences between the American and European Muslim communities in order to get to that precise question, which is, what can we do to make sure that the American Muslim community doesn't become like the European Muslim community? It's an important question in the war on terror, one where I think that people don't have like great answers to it, just because I don't see that anybody's actually sat down and thought this through and said there's a lot of shoot from the hip type answers. But one thing that I think is encouraging, there's currently among some Muslim organizations a move towards a greater program of civic engagement, basically from the podium, talking to, you know, during sermons, talking to Muslims about the need to engage within American society. I think civic engagement is one thing, one difference between American Muslims and European Muslims, in that American Muslims tend to be far more engaged, less ghettoized. A second thing, incidentally, is socioeconomic status of American Muslims. Like, we know from the studies that have been done of the American Muslim community that the average Muslim has twice the average annual income of the average American, which is, you know, astonishing and quite different from the situation that the socioeconomic status of the average Muslim in Europe. I think these are factors, and I think that both of those, civic engagement and also, you know, ensuring that Muslims don't face massive employment discrimination as they do in Europe, are two things that need to be done. But I think there's also a lot more than that. One final thing I'd throw out is continuing to be critical of organizations and imams that are transparently radical, because I think holding the American Muslim community accountable is a very important part of the process.
The back of the room, Beryl.
A number of questions have been raised in
The question is, what brought me away from Islam? I mean, if there's one thing that working for a radical Islamic charity and coming to adopt their views can do for you, it's really spur a crisis in faith. By 2000, you know, I'd left Al Haramain by then. I was scheduled to leave. I left amicably to go to law school. I spent my first year of law school as a radical Muslim. And you know, by the summer after my first year of law school, I realized that, you know, I really missed, you know, what I had before. You know, when I came to Islam, I thought of it as being this, you know, moderate and progressive faith. And you know, I was happy with what I practiced. You know, but I realized that my faith had you know, basically been inverted. Things that I thought were, you know, wrong 3 years ago, I now thought were right. And, you know, just having my worldview inverted and coming to distrust my moral inclinations was something that made me start to reevaluate my spiritual views. Ultimately, I didn't leave Islam after concluding that, you know, Islam was inherently radical. Instead, you know, this disaffection opened me up to basically a process of greater religious inquiry. I spend a whole chapter on this in the book, so I won't give away the punchline. But I will say that it was, you know, working for Al-Haramain, coming to accept their views, and seeing my worldview turn upside down, that opened up these greater questions.
Ma'am?
My question is, why now? The Muslim religion has been around for 1,500 years, whatever. Why is it that now, all of a sudden, you have all of this radicalism and so forth? What happened with recently that's brought us up?
The question is, why now with respect to radicalism when the Muslim faith has been around for 1,400 years? I think there's a number of answers to that question, a number of ways to look at that question. You know, one way you can look at it is, you know, tracing back early Muslim-Christian clashes, or early clashes between Islam and, you know, other societies. I mean, early Islam was very expansionist in nature. The entire Middle East and North Africa was Christian around at the time that Islam first came into being, and was quickly conquered over the course of a couple of centuries. For a while, you had Islamic armies trying to overrun Europe. Some people will argue that the reason why now is because we had a period in which Islam was essentially subjugated. You had colonialism, you had the Ottoman Empire collapsing, and that it was the fact that Islam was subjugated. Now, as you have oil revenues and Islam is becoming more ascendant, it becomes aggressive again. That's one way of looking at it. You know, another way of looking at it is more of an ideological way of movements within Islam. This way involves, you know, chalking up those early expansions to being something that, you know, was being done at the time in the name of a number of different faiths and movements. I mean, if you look back to when Islam first existed, in Europe, you had lots of people conquering each other constantly because that's what people did during the period. Under this view, it's ideologies such as Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the father of Wahhabism, and the views that he put forward about a stark contrast between Islam and unbelief, including the view that unbelief had to be conquered by force, that it was these views that became predominant in the 20th century because of things like oil money, as well as, you know, things like the Muslim Brotherhood movement rising up in response to colonial occupation. A movement that put this stark difference between Islam and unbelief and impelled violence. And I certainly hope that and the difference between those two is that for the first view, this is Islam inherently. Under the second view, it's not Islam inherently. It's what's being done in the name of Islam. I think that it's important to understand the debate between moderates and extremists within Islam. One thing that my book puts forward, one thing that pervades my book is that extremist arguments are not they're not the equivalent of Jim Jones or David Koresh, two men who claim to be representing Christianity, but whose views would be essentially unrecognizable. Extremists do draw on legitimate texts, legitimate scholarship, legitimate theological arguments. Ultimately, moderates also draw on legitimate arguments, legitimate sources, and the like. And the debate between the two is going to be critical in terms of the world that we face over the next several decades. I think personally that the thing we should all hope for is that it's not the religion, that instead, it's an interpretation of the religion, and, that bad theology can be conquered by good theology. To me, that's the assumption that I start from, because there are 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. And if the problem is with Islam, then the future is going to look a lot darker than the present. So I think the first thing to do is really to try to enforce moderates who have arguments that can take root. I think that's a good place to begin in our assumptions. So I hope that answered the questions, both by looking at kind of the development of Islam historically, particularly in the 20th century, as well as different ways to frame the conflict.
Amy?
The question is, do I have thoughts on where those moderates are and why they aren't speaking out? I think one problem that we have, I think the moderates are there, and I've been very encouraged by what I've seen over the last year and a half in terms of my interaction with Muslim moderates. I think that in some cases you have more going on in Muslim moderate circles than a lot of people pick up on. One magazine that I like quite a bit is called Islamica. It's the only Islamic magazine you can find in a Barnes & Noble. And, it's edited by moderate Muslims, not people who are necessarily the kind of guys who are going to, write manifestos and make these broad proclamations. But it puts forward a very interesting intellectual view of Islam. Another good website is altmuslim.com, which is a moderate Muslim website, which, again, it's not focused on bold proclamations and the like, but instead it has a distinctly moderate view. I do not believe that Muslim moderates do enough, but I also believe that they do more than a lot of people realize based on the coverage that's out there. And one problematic dynamic you have within the Muslim community is that a lot of times those guys who are standing up and making these bold proclamations and issuing manifestos and being vocally against terrorism, a lot of times they're saying the right things. But within the community, a lot of people have personality issues with these guys, which is often the case when people are proclaiming themselves leaders of a movement. And so some of the very outspoken moderates don't really get traction because people just don't like them and are kind of suspicious of their motives in doing this. One of my projects over the next several months is going to be actually documenting a little bit better some of the undercurrents going on in the Muslim community in terms of moderates finding a voice and doing interesting things, because I think that's a dynamic that's worth being aware of. Like I said, I don't think there's enough of it, but I think also there's more sometimes than you get a sense of by reading the popular press, because it's easy and important to focus on the negative, and sometimes these subtler positives do get overlooked.
We have 15 more minutes, sir.
There seems to be a real imbalance in my viewpoint. Our way of life, the Western world way of life, seems very much to be under attack. And our survival, some moment, seems like this. And yet, how do we balance our need to survive against the need, the perceived need of political correctness, and the need to try to bring in the community with those who will speak like millions of athletes versus this rivalry? Because we truly are under attack. And as a nation and as a Western way of life, if we think otherwise, we're nuts. We need to get out of the cave and recognize that we have a real threat to our survival. And how to balance this out? Because we don't hear from the moderates. They may be there, but they're within their own communities. They're disdain. And how do you combat the mentality of people willing to strap bombs on themselves so that they can be a better
life than
the one you have here? I mean, how do we try to balance that out?
Yeah, the question is, how do we balance the war we're fighting in terms of the need for our survival versus kind of the need to be inclusive or politically correct? And one thing I would say at the outset I think there's a difficult balance to be had, but I don't think the balance is really against the need to be inclusive or politically correct. Rather, in some ways, I'd see the need for inclusion as being wedded to our struggle for survival. That ultimately, in my view, the struggle for survival is linked to, you know, bringing about a better Islam. I don't think Islam is going anywhere. I think that as a religion, you know, it will still be one of the two largest religions in the world, you know, 100 years from now. And so I think that the question of this balance is inherently wedded to the current struggle. To me, I think what it comes down to in terms of the balance is speaking honestly, but weighing countervailing factors. So for example, I find that Muslims are much more receptive to discussing radicalism in their community when they believe that you, and I'm talking about American Muslims in particular, when they believe that you'll be fair about the community. I think that it's a fact that some Muslim figures come under unfair attack. Some of them come under very fair attack. You know, how do you distinguish between the two? Well, I think ultimately it's getting firsthand as opposed to secondhand knowledge that's kind of critical. Not everybody can get firsthand knowledge, but like actually knowing the players, talking to people who you trust as moderates, and kind of sizing up the community produces a very different view than you'd get simply by reading about it. And to me, one thing I will acknowledge is when a Muslim is treated unfairly, I'll speak out about that, just as I will speak out when a Muslim is radical. And to that extent, people take that much more seriously when you don't simply attack the community all the time. That's at least the way what it comes down to me is an issue of just integrity and treating Muslims fairly, but speaking the truth at all times, including when there are, including trying to make Muslims confront the dangerous elements within their community. And I believe that there is potential for that kind of engagement to work. Right now, though, I mean, I don't think we're far enough along as to where we should be, but I do have hope. And right now it's only 5 years into the war on terror. Overall, the situation domestically isn't dire, but it also, in terms of the American Muslim community, but it also sure isn't where it should be.
Yes.
Do you think the Muslim dictators will ever accept Israeli democracy and peace?
The question is, do I think Muslim dictators will ever accept Israeli democracy and peace? I don't know the answer to that. I think that's a difficult question, and one of those questions where, you know, you'd like it to be the case, but just because you'd like something doesn't ever mean that it will come about. So, you know, for that one, all I can give is my honest answer, which is I really just don't know.
And getting back to the question of whether the problem was with the position or a subset, I've not read the Quran, but I understand in media and reading articles that there are verses in there basically saying that Christians and Jews are pigs and or whatever animals they are. Did that make part of the Quran? And if so, big part of the sacred text, how much of a barrier does that form to the religion as a whole accepting other religions?
The question is one is whether there are, you know, bad verses in the Quran, and if so, what does that say about the religion as a whole? And the answer is yes, there are verses which are, I mean, the one that you're referring to in particular talks about how you shouldn't take Christians and Jews as friends. There is Surah 9, verse 29, which says that Muslims need to fight against the unbelievers until they either accept Islam or else are willing to pay the jizya and basically submit themselves to Islamic rule. You know, these are, like I said, extremists draw on legitimate verses. Now, the difference between, I think, an extremist and a moderate interpretation of Islam is the extremist will tend to universalize. So, you know, the verse about Christians or Jews, don't take them as friends. They'll say, you know, this is what it says. Don't take Christians and Jews as friends, period. The moderate will say, okay, when was this verse revealed? You know, it was revealed in the context of this dispute that Muhammad was having with, you know, the Jewish and Christian tribes in this region. So it's a verse that was revealed for this specific historical context. Like that's kind of that is the pattern of debate between moderates and extremists. Moderates will tend to universalize the more peaceful verses and will try to limit the warlike verses to being a specific context, while extremists will universalize the warlike verses and marginalize the peaceful verses. And that's what happens in the debate. I think it's a dynamic of debate that's worth understanding. And incidentally, I was asked before about, you know, determining the difference between extremists and moderates. That's one thing that actually provides a great indication. Those who tend to universalize as opposed to contextualize are more prone to an extremist interpretation. That's not to say they're necessarily extremists, but that's a methodology that extremists tend to use.
Sir, all the way in the back.
The question is one of the situation on campuses, both in terms of both in terms of Islamic extremism on campuses and also the anti-Israel movement on campuses. I don't know, you know, what hand it is behind this financially. I mean, one thing that people generally look to with respect to campus extremism is the Muslim Student Association network, which gets some foreign funding. And you have some very extreme Muslim student associations, including UCLA's Muslim Student Association, which had the picture of bin Laden on the front cover of their magazine, along with a laudatory profile prior to 9/11. But still, it's bin Laden. And you know, UC Irvine. This is a real phenomenon. I mean, fortunately, it's one which is more extreme at certain schools than others. Like the California school system has a lot of, you know, anti-Israel and, you know, frankly, anti-Semitic things going on there. In other places, you won't find as much like anti-Israel agitation. But I think that like the upswing in anti-Semitism, both on U.S. campuses and in Europe writ large, is an important phenomenon to understand and keep abreast of, because it's definitely happening. And I mean, with a lot of things, I feel like people, you know, on our side of the fence, the good guys end up getting blindsided by things like, you know, anti-Semitism, which is still very much below the radar, I think, of the mainstream media. You know, the demographic situation in Europe with the increasingly radical Muslim populations, coupled with the negative rate of growth from the native European population and this, you know, very quickly growing Muslim population. These are things that end up altering the world in ways that, you know, will be around for years or generations to come. And if you don't get abreast of the trends, they're going to smack you in the head.
One final question.
What do you think would happen to Islam if the Grand Mosque in Mecca and the Kaaba were to disappear?
The question is, what do I think would happen to Islam if the Grand Mosque in Mecca and the Kaaba were to disappear? I don't know. I mean, one thing Muslims believe is that the Kaaba is divinely protected. So it would question a lot of people's faith. I think also, you know, I mean, I know Tancredo, for example, Tom Tancredo talked about how nuking Mecca would be, you know, the response to an attack with a proper response to an attack with weapons of mass destruction. I think one thing that you would get is you know, a massive reprisal of the level of which we have never seen before. There's a lot of interesting, you know, questions that are outgrowths of that in terms of what would happen. Of what would happen demographically, and what would happen, you know, what would happen practically. In some instances, you know, I've seen discussions of, you know, what would happen if X happened to the Kaaba. Like, what would happen if the Kaaba, if someone took the Kaaba and put it on the moon, was one hypothetical question that was asked at one point. In which case, you know, the prayer direction would have to be switched to the moon, which would do some interesting things. Like, I think you'd have, for example, like these schools of Islamic thought, because you'd have to pray in the direction of the moon. So people would probably use like Velcro or suction cups. You'd probably have different like schools of Islamic jurisprudence arise based on these. But you know, ultimately, I don't think that there's a plan to do anything to, you know, to the Kaaba in Mecca. And I think that, you know, Tancredo's comment is a counterproductive one in the sense that it states that, you know, Islam is the enemy. That basically the view is, you know, we hold all Muslims accountable if, you know, if the terrorist group does it. And if a terrorist group attacks us, you know, we will punish all Muslims by destroying their very holiest site. And to me, you know, I think that it's worthy thinking through, you know, what happens if we get attacked through with weapons of mass destruction by terrorists. It's one of those questions that you have to think about, and you have to ask hard questions. I think, to me, like, his comment was more of kind of a shoot from the hip thing, and you need to think about the consequences of saying, well, you know, in response to what terrorists do, we're going to do something that will punish every single Muslim on the face of the earth.
It's now 1:30. We're going to conclude this lecture. I want to thank David for coming. Please join me. Books are over here available from Middle East Forum. Thank you for coming.